From KQED Public Radio and the California Report, this is the Capital Notes podcast for Friday, October 21st. I'm John Myers from KQED. Our friend Anthony York, how do I describe where Anthony is? Parts unknown. He didn't really tell me where he is. You can talk at any time. You don't have to be introduced, David.
Oh, he's on vacation.
He is. Oh, wow. He is on vacation, so we can talk about him.
Glad the Times is still giving vacation anyway.
Ah, see, that is a not Los Angeles Times reporter there. That's David Siders from the Sacramento Bee, who has been nice enough to come down the elevator and sit in the studio with me this morning. And David, this is your first time here. Are you thrilled? Or are you just?
It's a bit of a moment for me. Yeah, this is very nice. You know, people listen to this podcast, and I've always walked by the studio.
Well, I've always joked that we have four listeners. So those four are going to be very thrilled to hear you.
Is that your parents and mine?
Yours, actually, no, if yours are listening this week, that's six.
I will send them the tape, of course, or my wife will. So that's seven.
Send them the link, figure out they could listen to it.
And my daughter's two, so we force her to do whatever we...
Yeah, so David and I actually might have a podcast about little kids here, if you guys don't mind. Right, we'll just skip politics and we'll just talk about our children. So I asked David to come down. For those who don't know, David covers the governor a lot for the Sacramento Bee. As a matter of fact, I want to tell people that David Siders is the most reliable Jerry Brown cider. You cite him, you see him, you make sure we all know where he is. You are the press corps' eyes and ears for the governor.
That's nice of you. And even avoided the shadow moniker.
No. I like to call David the Brown Shadow. That's but of course, David doesn't like to be that. But you can see David. If you come to the Capitol sometime when something big's coming, you can see David sitting in the hallway with his laptop outside of the governor's office, sitting on the floor, making sure that man doesn't get out that door without being seen by David Siders.
Well, it's a job.
It's a good job. Now, it's not the only thing David covers. One of the things that David, that you covered this week, and you know, folks, as you heard last week, we were on a huge hiatus for so long that many of you wanted to send out a search party as to where I might be. And I was actually just working. But this is a quieter time in the world of politics in the Capitol, the legislature being in recess. And so our things that we're looking at are not as huge and all-important as they might be in any other given week. But that's all right. There are a few things that have been coming and going. And something that you wrote about this week I thought we might talk about, David, is this battle that was in court this week over Proposition 8. Not the typical court battle over Prop 8, which is a whole different ball of wax about the measure itself and its legality, its constitutionality, but about the donors of Prop 8. So,
yeah, I think this was an interesting case. These folks claimed some different ground. So the supporters of Prop 8, the people against gay marriage, tried to claim the same exemption to disclosure laws that the NAACP and the Socialist Workers Party in Alabama got the U.S. Supreme Court to grant them many years ago, claiming that their speech would be stifled otherwise. And so these people claimed that they were being harassed and, were pretty direct in their comparisons. At one point, the attorney said something to the effect of the attorney for the state said, this is not an abused minority, and in fact, the kind of harassment that they were alleging happens all the time. And the attorney for the pro-Prop 8 people said, just because it happens all the time, the same things happened with lynching and segregation. It doesn't make it right. So it was interesting to see these people standing on that ground, and ultimately the judge, who was skeptical throughout the hearing, decided against it. But I thought it was a novel argument anyway, and it will continue on. I believe it will be appealed.
What I find interesting, too, is that it does continue to go with this issue of what level of transparency is acceptable or should be, we should have, rather, and then also what the ramifications are of being politically active. I mean, you know, we in the press often are combing through these reports to see who the donors are, to try to understand the influence game. But in some cases, these are not people who by themselves are influential, but collectively with their money and their voices, they get something done. And that, I mean, that partly is the kind of people we're talking about here. We're not talking about large corporations that didn't want the publicity. We're talking about
Definitely true.
Average citizens who
And there was a good amount of argument about what the $100 limit that California has, and the pro-Prop 8 people saying that that limit should be much higher.
Maybe with the $100 triggering the disclosure.
The reporting.
Yeah.
Right. And so there were some nods to the press. Judge England likes to talk about, he has at least before when I've been in court, the importance of the media. And even the attorneys for the state said that, well, first of all, the pro-Prop 8 people said that the $100 limit is too low because, in fact, that discourages disclosure because it's so much information out there that nobody can make any sense of it. Well, the attorneys for the state said that you can see trends when you look at donations that low and that reporters are relied on to do that, and also academics. So there was a bit of conversation about that. I can't imagine that having – well, I certainly wouldn't benefit me or you or the jobs we do to have higher thresholds. We'd probably like it to be lower. We can sort out – I mean, if I want to in an Excel database, right, we could just knock out the people who are under $100.
Yeah. And also, too, I mean, you know, and this at the risk of going way too far down the world of campaign finance here and a rabbit hole that all the podcast listeners will say, I don't want to listen to that. But nonetheless, there are different triggers for disclosure. I mean, you know, somebody who gives $125 to a ballot measure campaign. Yes, they're ultimately disclosed, but they're not disclosed in a timely fashion like the larger donations, which we get that trigger of a number of days that we have to hit it. So these people aren't subject to, the disclosure, the eyes of the press or whoever it would be immediately. It's after the fact. And there's another parallel to another thing that I've been watching this week in that, which has been the issue about money being raised to in support of the referendum on the state Senate redistricting maps. The California Republican Party has got several hundred thousand dollars that it has already put forward. Well, party donations are not triggered the same way as campaign donations to the actual entity that's trying to get the signatures. So we won't know those people until later after the fact. It's not completely a parallel, but it does go to show there are levels of disclosure at different times. And so for me as a reporter, I don't know about you, but trying to draw this line back to saying that the disclosure automatically subjects you to scrutiny. I mean, it may down the road, but it doesn't always necessarily at the beginning of the day, unless you got a lot of money and you're getting that donation trigger where you've got to report it within 24 hours at the end of a campaign or a few days other times. These people aren't, you know, subject to it in that same way. So
that's true. There's quite a bit of delay, and in fact, in this case, their names have been public for years already. They're already out there. The attorney said they should be taken off, and the attorney did make an interesting case. He says that feelings about controversial issues like Prop 8 change over time. So what I may learn from looking at a disclosure database from the 2008 campaign in 2 years, he suggested that some of those people may have changed their mind on Prop 8 by then, and so it wouldn't really be informative. The judge, not so much.
So, you know, we're at this point of watching a lot of these other campaigns and transitioning into some of those. I mean, the referendum on the Senate redistricting one is one that is getting a lot of attention. There is money. There is debate around the Capitol, as you and I know, as to whether it's enough money to get it on the ballot. And they've got about 3 more weeks, and apparently they were halfway or more than halfway there to getting the signatures they need. And, of course, just because you get it on the ballot doesn't mean you actually have money then for a successful campaign. Mm-hmm. But there are a number of other referendum ideas out there. As a matter of fact, I mean, I'm sure somebody who listens to the podcast will email me back and tell me I should have had this number right to go before or will tell me what it is. But this is easily the most proposed referendum measures that I have seen in the 10 years that I've been sitting here at the Capitol in any given year. I mean, this has been so many referendum measures we've had. We had one that ran out of time here recently, which was the referendum of the legislation mandating that textbooks in schools have contributions of LGBT Californians. So that referendum failed to get enough signatures in time. We've had a referendum filed over the California Dream Act, that allows undocumented students to be eligible for financial aid at colleges and universities. That was a referendum filed by Tim Donnelly, the assembly member from the Inland Empire. We have a referendum now filed against the governor's signature on the bill that loosens the requirements of using the E-Verify system to see whether someone is an illegal immigrant or not. You know, all of those filing a referendum buy-in in itself doesn't mean a whole lot because you still have to have money to get the signatures. You only have 90 days to get the signatures. It's a tough hurdle there. And then the other one that really was where I was getting with all of this. Well, David is now finding out that sometimes I have to get to my place here. He's just you're along for the ride. Is the referendum against Senate Bill 202, which got a lot of attention at the end of session. This is the measure that we know moves all initiatives from June ballots to November ballots. Let's roll back in that since you weren't in here when we were talking about that, David. Your take on the governor's decision process there. I mean, you watch the guy a lot.
First of all, just from a process standpoint, I thought it was remarkable that they got those referendum papers filed within, 2 hours on that Friday afternoon?
They had them ready to go, apparently.
And I think they needed to, because if you look at the time, the timeline for signing or for getting the referendum going starts from the date the bill is chaptered. So it was curious why the governor would release that on a Friday afternoon, say, instead of waiting until the Sunday midnight drop, right? But by releasing it on a Friday afternoon, there was a reasonable possibility that over the weekend, those papers might not have been filed and he would have gained a couple of days. And in fact, Monday was Columbus Day. It was a holiday. So he had 3 days potentially there. And so you suffer the Saturday A1 story or the Saturday lead story, but maybe you get that time. They beat him on that.
That's actually, I hadn't thought about that, but that, you're a smart man because I think that's actually a much, because my, people kept asking me, when do you think the 202 bill decision is going to come down? I thought, you bury it on a Saturday night or something or something, whatever time. Well, no, right. You made a great point. By doing it then, you've left the proponents of the referendum less time to get their stuff going. They still do not. I mean, I tried to get a hold of the attorney who filed it this week. He has not gotten back to me. So anytime you want, Mr. Bell, I'm here. But, trying to assess whether there's money behind this measure and whether someone would. I mean, the sense that I have gotten around the Capitol is that it's a tough sell. There are a lot of things that people need money for in this election year coming up. Getting the money to get it on the ballot could easily be $2-3 million. Then there's a campaign. There's a whole source of questions there, and whether you can, if you don't like this law, you don't like the change, whether you can find the money for it's a different story.
So could see the Paycheck Protection people maybe getting involved. I don't know, but I'm
if they still have the money,
have a serious interest.
That of course is the ballot measure that is the most impacted, or actually one of two ballot measures that's most impacted by this change. It's the one that the initiative that looks like it's on the way to qualifying, or at least on the way to getting its signatures, I should say, that limits the political spending by organized labor and ostensibly corporations. Though the most dramatic impact would be organized labor. Corporations tend to give money in ways that are different than the way the initiative addresses. That's supposed to be on the June ballot. They wanted it on the June ballot because they think there'll be high Republican turnout. Now it would be on a November ballot. Curious that November ballot starts to look awfully big now, doesn't it? Who knows how many measures we're talking about, but we've got legislative measures. I mean, we've got a lot of stuff.
It's true. It'll be interesting to see, too, how the signature gathering, if it gets to that point where they're really on the street and paying for these gather, how the gatherers bundle those. I'm curious when I go to Target to see, how the person who's getting $2 for one signature and maybe 50 cents for another or whatever the pay ends up being, how they bundle them on the stands.
Which one's on top?
No idea.
All right, which one's on top?
Yeah, but I'm kind of curious.
While you're signing this one, how about that one?
Well, that's how they do it, right? Yeah. But I'm curious if it'll be different tables for, I just don't know. Yeah. Do you sign the prop? Not the Prop 8, but the Donnelly measure at the same time you're doing two. Well, maybe.
From your vantage point, was there any surprise that the governor signed SB 202 to move all these measures? Given the reaction it has had in Republican circles and the ability now they say to work with the governor on all the other issues come the fall, given the governor's previous life. experience with June ballots, and as Secretary of State in the 70s, he was the one that advocated you could put them on the June ballot. Was there any surprise to you, or is it more simple in other political equations? I mean, what did you make up?
Well, I don't think it was any surprise. At heart, the governor is a partisan Democrat and has a history of that.
That's shocking. No, I'm just kidding. Yeah.
But also has maybe an experience this year of things having not worked out so well with his bipartisan efforts. He certainly was frustrated by, you know, certainly 6 months in. And I don't think there's any surprise that he may believe it's good government as well. He may think that it's good government and also that it has this other benefit, or that it has this other benefit and also that it's good government. But I don't think observers were shocked.
And either way, exactly. It. But what you've made as an interesting point is that regardless of which thing was driving which, it was the decision that, you know, he thought was the right one to make. So, and what do you make of this notion? I mean, we heard a lot of reaction immediately after he signed it from Republicans. It's, you know, poison the atmosphere here. We can't work together. But as we try to look forward to what's coming up, because we know we've got another budget mess, I think is safe to say, coming in December and January and after that. What do you make of that? What do you make of any dynamic change that it might have created or will create?
You know, there was that, and then there were the vetoes. He had some snarky messages for Republicans, right? Or even in some of his signing messages. I don't know. I tend to think that these people will look at the issues rather discreetly, and that one thing the governor hasn't done is made such a bad personality clash with these Republicans that they won't talk to him based on that. I think we saw in the Republicans' decisions for most of the year that it wasn't because of any personal animosity they had with the governor, but because of some, well, pretty strict political standards they had. And I would imagine that would drive their thinking next year, and also the governor's. I don't sense that any one thing this year is poisoning the well.
What do you...
What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I don't know. No, I'm asking you. I mean, I think that it's hard to make the well much more poison than it has been over the last few years. No one would say that people get along famously well as it is. I do think you make a good point that, you know, lawmakers on both sides of the aisle are going to have to decide what issues they carry near and dear and what ones they're willing to let go, and, you know, and kind of what you get and what you don't get. And I think one of the dynamics that you and I and others, press and the public, has been watching over this first year of the Brown administration is the governor's desire to figure out whether there's a pragmatic streak in his mind in the Republican caucuses in the legislature, and his determination at the end, in the way he has said it and enacted, is that there's not any pragmatism, that there's not enough pragmatism, that they aren't willing to get X and give up Y. Of course, Republicans will hear you say, will say on the other side that they're being principled, which I think is a very interesting, we won't have the side topic now in the podcast, about whether, you know, they are being unfairly portrayed as being stick in the muds or obstructionists rather than being principled, which they would say they're being. Again, different podcast. But so I think this level of pragmatism, you know, is going to again come out. You're going to find members who are going to say, this matters to me more than this. And yeah, this sucks, but yes, I'd rather have this. And I mean, that's kind of the nature of life politics. Sorry, I'm getting waxing deeply here, but you know, I mean,
I think that's the case. I think next year, we'll have a good shot at that. I think we will see less of a focus on maybe we learned this year that wine and cheese at your loft doesn't make a budget deal, and that it really wasn't with Schwarzenegger only that he didn't know the lawmakers' names, as much as both Meg and the governor talked about that in last year's campaign, that there will have to be something more real next year if these people will agree on something.
Well, certainly one thing that we're waiting, watching for is and you probably were at the event. What am I saying? I've already called you the Brown Shadow, but you probably were at the event. No, don't laugh off mic, David. This is live to tape. You react real and genuine for the podcast audience.
I'm not stiff at all.
No, but he was just trying to be polite, folks. But the comment the governor made about his pension plan, which we're waiting for, pension changes plan, which said that it was going to be a constitutional change. And that's something we're watching and waiting for, right? I mean, that's and that is another dynamic to add into here, because a constitutional change, to get it on the ballot, requires, shockingly, votes from the Republican caucus.
Indeed. Well, or an initiative.
True, right. One way or the other.
And he said that one part of it may be that, or will be that. And it's unclear, of course, what part that would be. But one guess is it could be something to do with the makeup of the board, the retirement board. I forget the number of the initiative, but it was maybe in 1992 there was a measure that would have changed the Constitution to have to do with retirement. So it could be looking to alter some of that. Otherwise, it's unclear what substantively would be in that amendment. And for the rest of the plan, we have no idea. He keeps saying, I'm going to come out with a plan.
I have a plan.
Come back tomorrow.
Yeah. I have a plan. I think we heard that, too, during the election at some point, where I've got a plan for the budget.
But I'm not going to show it to you.
Ask me about it after the election.
There is a certain brilliance in that, because he does tend to, for example, you know, the education thing that he ran into when he vetoed Steinberg's bill on changing the standardized, not STI, the
Academic Performance Index, the API.
Yeah, thanks. The not sexually transmitted.
That's a different podcast, as we like to say here on the Capitol News podcast.
But I think when Whitman was beating up on him last year for failing to have a plan, do you remember this day that we kind of woke up and at midnight the previous night, Brown had released on his website two plans. One was for education, and I think the other was for the environment. And it was, okay, there he has some plans. And he was pretty specific in there about his criticisms of the API. And then down in L.A. the other week, he says he vetoed Steinberg's bill because it would have gutted the API.
I bring up a lot of this largely, and we'll wrap up here in a moment, but I bring up a lot of this largely because, again, I'm looking toward that November 2012 ballot. Governor now has put pensions as a notification that he wants the voters to consider something about public employee pensions in November 2012. We know that they're going to consider something about the government realignment of local state government. Mm. Probably two portions of that in some way. Maybe it's one measure or two measures. One is certainly the mechanics of what locals are in charge of, what states are in charge of. That's being talked about by local government representatives, you know, the counties and others up here. Then there's the funding for all of that, which gets us back to the mighty tax issue, that we still don't know what that tax issue would look like on the November 2012 ballot. Then we've got all these initiatives that are coming down the pike that have nothing to do with it. We've the paycheck protection, you know, political contribution one we've talked about, anything else that could be coming, a referendum apparently on Senate maps. The ballot gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And as you and I know, the historical tendency of voters when faced with a huge ballot is to say, ah, I can't figure all this out, knowing all of it, you know. And therein lies, I think, part of the challenge is how many things the governor can sell to the public next year, how many he's thinking about trying to sell, and how he gets his message out in the cacophony of all the noises of all the other political efforts that could be there. It's shaping up to be a very interesting, unusual fall 2012 campaign season.
Could be huge. Maybe we should just have a constitutional convention instead.
Might make it simpler, right?
One thing the governor has on his side is his approval rating, that everybody else is tanking in California, and somehow he's...
And he's somewhere around 42%, which in politics in California is pretty darn good. I mean, it's...
You could put him at the front of a campaign.
Before we end, I want to just, if you wouldn't mind, just sharing with folks what it's like. I mean, you really do. You have been assigned by the good folks at the Bee to tail around and make sure, you know, if the governor says something interesting, we all know about it. And you had, just talk about this week. What happened to you this week?
Well, this week it's been very quiet. The governor's only had the one public event.
And Santa Clara, right?
That's right. He went over for a...
But you had to go and just...
Well, had to go. I will. I just must say that there is a certain luxury to being able to work at, and not to plug for the Bee too much.
Oh, come on, plug away. I'm sure they might be listening.
It is a luxury to work for a newspaper that can that has the dedication and the resources to keep sending you out, even when they anticipate that an event may not produce a story, may not produce greater threads that they see a value in being there.
And so didn't that kind of happen this week?
Well, indeed. So you drive to Santa Clara for 3 hours and end up getting, I think he spoke for 1 minute and 58 seconds, and to everybody's disappointment, didn't even take a shot at Rick Perry. Ugh.
Now he was, you have to explain why he was
so
there.
So he was there to celebrate Dell was, I guess, doing a ribbon cutting for a new facility they have there. A couple of hundred jobs. And so the governor shows up, they issue a release. But because Rick Perry, the governor of Texas, has been chest thumping for so long about how he likes to come hunt jobs from California, here you had an example of a high-profile Texas-based company making an investment in California. There was some expectation or hope in the audience. That
from a certain reporter who works for a newspaper that rhymes with
well, and not just me. I will say there were other reporters who traveled there, and at least from San Francisco, and felt that maybe it wasn't so productive. He was in – anyway, the governor was in a diplomatic mood, and so there were no firings at Rick Perry.
Damn, that just doesn't – that story didn't write itself is what you're
certainly
saying.
Certainly doesn't sell papers.
So, folks, you can be rest assured that if, in fact, the governor has 90 seconds to talk, David Siders will be there. I actually should just get you to start carrying a microphone. You could, like, you know, you kind of double up for those of us in the broadcasting world. I'd be set.
That's a scary precedent. We need not – I would like us both to be employed.
We need two jobs, not one, because we then start talking about our poor children. With that, we'll wrap it. David, you're good to come down. I appreciate it.
Thank you. It was so nice to be here.
Hey, you know, we'll allow the full snark of it all maybe next time when York comes back. He has kind of a tendency to bring out the smart alecky side of all of us.
So. I've heard I would like to see that, yeah.
See it in action. That's David Siders from the Sacramento Bee. I'm John Myers from KQED. We'll see you next time.